Well, by now you know me, and you know that I like a lot of the UU jokes that I bring to you on occasion. And I thought for a few minutes of talk on our individual Unitarian Universalist journeys, I'd open with this UU joke. Did you hear the one about the Unitarian Universalist who fell off a cliff and caught a branch to hang onto on the way down? Some of you have. So this poor fellow is hanging on this branch, looking down at a very, very steep drop and looking up to the cliff above, and is just suspended there. And he yells out, "Is anyone up there?" Then he hears a mysterious voice, like no voice he had ever heard before. The voice says, "Yes." And the Unitarian Universalist yells up, "I need help." The voice says, "Let go." The UU looks up again at the steep cliff and then looks way down at the drop below and says, "Who are you?" "God." "God? Really?" "Yes, son. And I am telling you to have faith and let go." The man looked down the long, steep cliff again and said, "Is there anyone else up there?" Over the years, I have culled jokes like this from Unitarian Universalist Church newsletters, from UU colleagues, from websites, wherever I can find them. And I've got quite a folder of them now. One of our saving graces is our sense of humor, our willingness to laugh at ourselves. Jokes about Unitarian Universalists tend to run in a similar vein to this one that I just offered. They say something about who we are. We're skeptical, we're seekers, and we tend to shy away from creeds and certainty. One of our distinguishing features is that we are creedless. We don't have a statement of belief. We do, of course, have a statement of basic principles. You see it every week on the order of service. But we do not have a specific theological belief statement which all of our members are expected to subscribe to. Of course, we individually have many beliefs, and many of them coincide. Historically, our two traditions of organized Unitarianism and Universalism did begin with faith assertions. During the Protestant Reformation, Unitarians rejected the traditional Christian belief in the Trinity, the notion that God is three persons in one. Instead, the early Unitarians affirmed a unitary God, with Jesus not as equal to God, but as a prophet, or as God's special messenger. The faith assertion of the Universalists was the radical idea of universal salvation. All people are saved, not just those who believe the proper things or do good works or who are especially chosen for salvation. All people, said the Universalists, all people will enter heaven. At the time when Universalists believed in some kind of an afterlife, they said that the last sinner will be dragged into heaven, kicking and cursing. That's how strong their belief was, that no matter what you did in this life, you are destined for universal salvation. Well, these two things are faith statements: one God, universal salvation. Both were considered serious heresy by traditional Christianity, and you could be ridiculed, banished, or burned by the Roman Catholic Church or by the Protestant reformers for asserting these beliefs at the wrong time and wrong place. Some brave souls persisted in questioning traditional beliefs, and because they did so over the decades, we are here today, part of a merged denomination, the Unitarian Universalist Association, and we are the heirs of these free thinkers. The original Unitarian and Universalist faith positions are no longer what defines and distinguishes us now, but we have inherited from our religious forebears their questioning and questing spirit. It is this spirit that is the core of who we Unitarian Universalists are today. As our statement of principles asserts, we covenant together as congregations to affirm and promote a free and responsible search for truth and meaning. The wording in our fourth principle of ours is very important. We believe in the free search, but we want to engage in it responsibly. As Unitarian Universalist religious educator Sophia Lyon-Foss said, "The freedom for which we stand is not freedom to believe and do as we please, not freedom to live in a world of fancy, not freedom to evade responsibility, not freedom to pretend good is bad and bad is good. It is rather the freedom to be honest in speech and action, the freedom to question, to investigate, to try to understand life and the universe in which life abounds, the freedom to respect one's own integrity of thought and feeling, the freedom to search anywhere and everywhere to find the meaning of being, the freedom to experiment with new ways of living that seem better than the old." Freedom without a sense of responsibility toward oneself and others on this quest can lead to a shallow and uncritical faith at best, and a dangerous one at worst. A David Koresh or Jim Jones using freedom from the religious traditions that they started in to lead their followers down a path of self-destruction could be the result of freedom without responsibility. While we search, we Unitarian Universalists bear in mind that we may not find all the answers. We are aware that we are on a perpetual quest, and we take a certain joy in being on the road, seeking without feeling that we have to find the answers once and for all. That really does distinguish us. Yet, like others of any or of no faith, we share in the human yearning, a yearning to know the truth, to know what the meaning of existence is. How did it all begin? How will it end? Where did we come from? Where are we going? What is the purpose of life? Is there a God, an infinite power, an absolute? These questions have riddled human existence, of course, throughout history, and they have given rise to a multitude of philosophies, religious faiths, and scientific theories. I'd like to read a little piece out of literature, out of the novel Point Counterpoint by Aldous Huxley, about one older person's perpetual search for truth, and how he thought he nailed it. So there is an older man calling his brother on the phone. He says, "Edward, is that you?" said a deep voice not unlike Lord Edward's own. "This is me, Edward. I've just this moment discovered a most extraordinary mathematical proof of the existence of God, or rather of..." "But this isn't Lord Edward," shouted Illich. "Wait, I'll get him." So this was a butler who answered. He turned back to the old man. "It's Lord Gattendon," he said. "He's just discovered a new proof of the existence of God." He did not smile. His tone was grave. Gravity in the circumstances was the wildest derision. The statement made fun of itself. Laughing comment made it less, not more, ridiculous. Marvelous old imbecile, Illich felt himself revenged for the evening's humiliations. A mathematical proof, he added, more seriously than ever. Oh, dear, exclaimed Lord Edward, as though something deplorable had happened. Telephoning always made him nervous. He hurried up to the instrument. Charles says to Edward, "Ah, Edward," cried the disembodied voice of the head of the family from 40 miles away at Gattendon. "Such a really remarkable discovery. I wanted your opinion on it, about God. You know the formula M over naught equals infinity, M being any positive number? Well, why not reduce the equation to a simpler form by multiplying both sides by naught, in which case you have M equals infinity times naught? That is to say that a positive number is the product of zero and infinity. You following? Doesn't that demonstrate the creation of the universe by an infinite power out of nothing? Doesn't it?" The diaphragm of the telephone receiver was infected by Lord Gattendon's excitement 40 miles away. It talked with breathless speed. Its questions were earnest and insistent. "Doesn't it, Edward?" All of his life, the fifth Marquess had been looking for the absolute. For 50 years, he had trundled in his wheelchair at the heels of the elusive quarry. Could it be that he had now caught it so easily and in such an unlikely place as an elementary school book on the theory of limits? It was something that justified excitement. "What's your opinion, Edward?" "Well," Edward began, and at the other end of the electrified wire, 40 miles away, his brother knew from the tone in which that single word was spoken that it was no good. The absolute's tale was still unsalted. Many, many people over the eons have tried to salt the tale of the absolute. Some would say that they have done it. They know the truth. Personally, I believe that it is not given to us humans to know all the answers. As astronomer Timothy Ferris has said, "The more we know about the universe, the more we come to know how little we know." Zen philosopher Alan Watts once nicely summed up the difficulty. He said, "The universe is so damn wiggly." What I believe distinguishes Unitarian Universalists in general from many others who have asked the ultimate questions is that basically, we're willing to tolerate a wiggly universe. We're willing to accept some ambiguity and uncertainty with regard to the answers. The poet John Keats called this capacity negative capability, the ability, as he put it, to live with uncertainties, mysteries, doubts, without any irritable reaching after fact and reason. There is a Tibetan Buddhist myth about a people who lived in a beautiful country, a people who worked hard and whose leaders believed that their prophet had the truth. This prophet was revered by the people because they believed he had the truth. One day, the people followed him to the foot of a mountain. The prophet carried a giant, brilliant diamond on his head. It was called the Truth Diamond. He carried it up the mountaintop, and the people followed. And there it shone for all the people with a blinding light. Then he threw it down the mountain, and it smashed into millions of tiny pieces, whereupon the prophet disappeared. The people scrambled to collect the tiny pieces of this truth diamond. And each family or each small group jealously guarded its own little piece, a tiny piece of the truth. Families began to build walls around their own fragments. And so it is that each person or group possesses one small fragment of truth, a fragment that is sometimes jealously guarded and defended. Yet no one has the whole truth. As we travel the road of a free and responsible search for truth and meaning, either individually or in a group like this particular religious community, we may from time to time find a little fragment, a piece of that truth diamond, a tentative truth perhaps that we can believe in for a time. This may be a great joy to us and those with whom we share it, as long as we don't build a wall around it and cling to our tiny fragment as if that's all there is, for then we would be closing off our minds and our hearts to new insights, to different experiences, to fresh viewpoints. I want to close early and give you a chance to interact. You were having so much fun interacting before, and now you'll have a chance to interact in a little more structured way in a few moments here. But I would like to close first with the words of Ralph Waldo Emerson. Emerson said, "Nothing is secure but life, transition, the energizing spirit. No truth is so sublime, but it may be trivial tomorrow in the light of new thoughts. People wish to be settled," said Emerson, "only insofar as they are unsettled is there any hope." Now what I'd like to ask you to do is to think for a moment. I'm about to offer the class Building Your Own Theology, as many of you know. And I just want to take a little piece out of that, what I consider the core of the Building Your Own Theology curriculum, which is a set of guidelines for people to write their own spiritual autobiographies. We have some writing implements, and Bob will take them around. And you can just sketch on, you know, take notes on whatever piece of paper you have, including the order of service, of course. There are three different questions here to help people write their spiritual autobiographies. And this is just a little piece of a larger exercise, which we obviously won't do this morning. But I would like to ask you to just pick one of these three and jot down some notes for yourself. And then I would like to ask you to team up with three or four people nearby. We don't have to travel very far, to share what you've written or what you've thought about. So the first question is, life functions in space. So the first is about space, places. What are the places in which significant things have happened to you? You could just list a few places. That's one option. Second option, all life is meeting others. Who are the three or four people who have had the greatest impact on your life and why? The notes are just for yourself. And the third option is experiences shape our religious faith. What are two or three formative experiences of your life and why are they important to you? I'll repeat these. First is space. Can you think of a few spaces, maybe they're sacred spaces to you, that have helped to form your particular point of view, your faith? Second is meeting others. Who are two or three or so people who you've met who've had a great influence on you? And the third is experience. Can you think of two or three formative experiences? And why were they important to you? That you can do by sharing. The notes are just for you to remember either the spaces, the people, or the experiences. So those three. But just pick one, because we won't have time to discuss much more than one with each other. And that briefly. Now I'd like to have you, if you need to turn your chairs just a little, but just group in groups of three or four. And let one person share while the other two or three listen, and then switch when it seems time to switch. Just this little bit of sharing with one another. Yeah. You are never at a loss for words, all of you. And it's fun to talk in groups, and sometimes it's fun to have a specific purpose in mind and a specific question to answer. So I can, some of you can't stop. That's great. So we just had a little taste of the kind of deep thinking and talking that we can have with one another. What a great religious tradition to be a part of, to be able to do this.